Today's shiur is probably a little bit different than what you're used to hearing at Kol Yom Rishon. I pride myself in trying to do different kinds of things. This shiur is going to look at Avelus, at mourning, and also look at some of the Kabbalistic ideas with the journey of the soul after death. I am not a Mekubal. I am just old enough to learn Kabbalah in the first place. But there are some basic Kabbalistic ideas, I think, that can add a tremendous amount of understanding to the laws of Avelus, the way they are practiced. I'm a big believer, in general, of looking deeply at the customs that we keep and trying to really understand them. You know, there's of course a debate as to whether or not we should look too far into Tamei HaMitzvos. Something is a mitzvah mid'oraisa. How far should we be looking into the tam for the mitzvah? After all, at the end of the day, how far are we going to get as far as the divine mind, etc., etc.? However, when things are mid'rabbanan, and when things are minhagim, and things of that nature, I think sometimes we hold ourselves back from approaching it fully, and we really could and should go further into understanding the things that we do. And with that in mind, I'm going to try to look at something that we're fairly familiar with. We're going to start with the pretty familiar, and we're going to move from the pretty familiar into the very, very not familiar. So I apologize if the beginning of the shiur, especially those who have lost a parent, will be very familiar with what I'm going to talk about. As we move into the shiur, we'll probably add additional layers that are things that you perhaps haven't thought about or don't yet know about. Our rabbis tell us that histaka b'oraisa ubara alma, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked at the Torah and he created the world. That concept that HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked at the Torah and then created the world is one I think we underestimate. What that means, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked at the Torah and then created the world. We understand that somehow the world is based on a Torah blueprint. We understand perhaps that things in the world are set up to accomplish the laws of the Torah. But the reality is that if we take that idea seriously, that histakel be'oraisa ubara alma, we can perhaps understand that the reason why we have tefillin straps is not because we have arms, but the reason why we have arms is because we have tefillin straps. Very interesting way of thinking about the world. In other words, we generally assume that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and again, once we think about it, this doesn't make any sense. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, and then he created the Torah to work with it. That's really compromising HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ability for forward thinking. Anybody who's doing strategic planning knows you don't build a building and then figure out how to use it. You figure out what you need, and then you create the blueprints. When we say histakel be'oraisa ubara alma, means HaKadosh Baruch Hu created this world with for certain Torah purposes. What that means from a Torah perspective, from a mourning, M-O-U, mourning perspective, is the following very interesting idea. That it's not that the laws of mourning are there so that we can be helped through our grief, but that grief exists so the laws of mourning can possibly be meaningful. Sounds like a wild idea. How important could Avelus be that God would create feelings in order that the mourning, but that's the direction we're going to try to take. We're going to try to find an incredible amount of meaning to the extent of our ability to understand what Chazal were doing. And we're going to be guessing. But we're going to try the best of our ability to understand what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was doing in creating some level of mourning and what Chazal were doing by expanding the mourning to try to really understand exactly how these laws are essential, what they're trying to do, and perhaps why feelings that we have inside were created to go along with the stages of mourning and not necessarily the other way around. An interesting proposition. Let's look at what we consider to be the stages of mourning. Okay, we're not going to look at them from purely halachic terms, but we're going to look at them four times this morning. We're going to go through the process from death until the first yahrzeit. We're going to look at it four different times with four different levels of meaning, and I hope we'll be able to bring out some stuff that is really mind-blowing. Really mind-blowing. I know that when I try to share this with my own congregants in the Young Israel of Holliswood, that it's very, very comforting to begin to understand what these laws are driving at and what the feelings that a person has are there to accomplish. If you look at the first page of the source sheet, you have a number of stages in the process of a person leaving this world. The reality is that according to many opinions, and the Nefesh HaChayim of Yechiel Michal Tukachinsky, who lived in Eretz Yisrael at the beginning of the 1900s, he wrote the book Gesher HaChayim, The Bridge of Life, and he's done a lot of the work that we'll speak about today. The third page is completely from his book. There are those who consider illness and the illness that precedes death to actually be part of the death process. That there is actually a beginning of a tshuva process for the family. There's a beginning of a process for the neshama. We've all heard stories that people in the days before they died had a sense they were going to die, perhaps brought back some vision of the next world even before they died. But we're going to leave that for now because we're going to try to focus on Avelus itself. The moment of death, Yetzias HaNeshama, has various halachos associated with it. Okay? We're familiar with the concept that at the moment of death, the person is supposed to be saying Vidui, if possible, Shema Yisrael. And there's a debate about whether or not one should tear their clothes when a person's soul leaves. The Gesher HaChaim and many others paskin that today we don't tear our clothes at the moment that a person passes away, because what was happening was people were so concerned about their clothes that they happened to sneak out at the key moment. The Kabbalah tells us that it's very comforting for the soul to have family members and others around at the moment of Yetzias HaNeshama. It's a very confusing time for the person. And we want people to be in the room. And we found that the fact that a person had to rip their clothes was a deterrent to be standing there in the room at the time. So the Gesher HaChaim and others said, we don't tear. And that's what many people do. We don't tear at the time of Yetzias HaNeshama. We wait till the Levaya, the Kavura, in order to tear. The next stage from death until burial is called aninus aninut, and that is, for those who have experienced it, a very, very bizarre time. The most salient feature of that time is a patur from mitzvot. A patur from mitzvot, which for a person who has been keeping the mitzvot all of their life, is a time which is rather bizarre. People feel very, very displaced at this particular time. They don't do any positive mitzvot. All the no-nos are still in effect, but a person doesn't say brachos, a person doesn't daven. And there are various reasons given for that stage. And we'll go through that, and the next time around, we'll try to explain why that might be. Why would it be that you're pater from mitzvot from the time of the death until the time of the burial? The next period, the first 3 days, and this people are not quite as familiar with, there's a halachic difference between the first 3 days of Shiva and the next 4 days of Shiva. Today it's not that felt. It's not that felt. Most Shiva homes run pretty much the same way right from the beginning, but the reality is that the first 3 days, Gimel Yomim Lebechi, the first 3 days of intense crying is a time within halacha where we actually don't encourage shiva calls. We don't kick people out, but we don't actually encourage shiva calls except for those who are closest to the person. It's supposed to be a time where the person is so deeply in their mourning that we're almost not ready to bring them out. And we'll have to talk about what's supposed to go on at a shiva home and to what extent are we trying to bring the person out. What is that about? The first 3 days is a time when we discourage, on some level, shiva visits. We discourage the person from leaving the home even if there's a tremendous financial need. The prohibitions involved with work apply even by a person who has a tremendous financial need. 3 days a person is just supposed to sit. We're pretty familiar with the halachos of shiva from the halachos of Tisha B'Av. A pretty similar kind of experience the last 4 days of the shiva, which really ends up being 3 days and a little bit. A period of intense restrictions, one of the most intense times in a person's life in terms of halacha. Halacha is very intense. Every move is dictated by the halacha, and the person is limited to the home. The next period, which is shloshim, which is really not 30 days, because of course it's from day 7 until the end of the 30 days, many of the restrictions are lifted. This is the equivalent, for those who have not sat shiva and shloshim, of the 9 days. Basically, we're focused on a person's comfort or discomfort. They're not allowed to shave, they're not allowed to take a haircut, they're not allowed to wear particularly clean clothes and things of that nature. They feel very shvach. That's sort of the next stage of those 30 days. During the first year, and of course the first year only applies at the death of a parent, during the first year, the idea is to basically refrain from certain joyous activities, from simchas, from weddings, from music, and things of that nature. And finally, the anniversary of the death, the yahrzeit, brings with it that year, the first year in most years, not in a leap year, but when the 12 months ends with the yahrzeit, ends with the day of the death, the day of the burial. When the first year ends immediately with the yahrzeit, it usually is part of the Yud Bet Chodesh. When you have a leap year, and there's an extra month there between the end of the 12 months and the day of the death, so then usually it's kept in a more minor way. And for future years, the yahrzeit is kept as a low-level avelus. Very low level. Generally, you just don't go to a wedding on the avelus, and on the yahrzeit, and there are different minhagim about fasting. What's going on here? Sometimes we can get caught up in the details of the laws of avelus and miss what each stage is about. I'm not going to be able, because of my limited knowledge, to give you an explanation of why this halacha particularly applies during shiva and that halacha particularly applies in shloshim, but I think it's helpful, and it's very helpful for people who are going through it, to get a sense for what's basically going on at each stage. Put the restrictions together and what do you got? What's the sum of the parts at each stage in the avelus? And again, we're going from the more simple explanations, and each time we go through it, we'll add something else. What is, first of all, aninus? Why should a person be absolved from mitzvot at this particular time? So the most common explanation is something that runs along the lines of oseik b'mitzvah, pater min ha-mitzvah. A person during aninus, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, take care of your deceased. I'm okay. Don't worry about me for a couple of days. Don't go out and eat treif on the way. There's no reason for you to stop at McDonald's on the way to the Beis Olam. But I don't want you to have to go to shul when you're busy taking care of your mace. And that actually produces certain halachic differences. What if you don't need to? Tosfot discuss. What if you don't need to take care of the mace? What if there's a chevra kadisha in town? What if you're not going to the funeral and it's on the other side of the world? What if you have nothing to do with the arrangements? Do you suddenly become chayev in mitzvot? What if Shabbos comes? What if Shabbos is between the death and the burial? Well, you can't do it very much on Shabbos anyway, so should you be putter from mitzvot on Shabbos? And generally we say no, you go back to different things on Shabbos. That's the simplest and probably most far-reaching explanation of what happens at Aninus. You're putter from mitzvos because you have something to do. You should be fully focused on taking care of the needs of the deceased. The reality is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't need my stamp of approval, but from a psychological perspective, this is incredibly helpful. Incredibly helpful. Because there is a huge amount of guilt that is associated with the feeling of not doing enough at those critical moments at the end of life. It's unfortunately there with many families as people are sick. And it is certainly possible that they would feel that feeling from the time of death until the time of the burial. A person is conflicted. I have to go to shul, I have to do my things, but I also have to take care of the burial arrangements for this person. The halacha states you don't have to do anything else. Take care of your mace right now. From a psychological perspective, it is very, very healthy for the person to be able to say, I did everything that I could. Because the reality is that in 2 days or in 1 day or by that night, there's nothing more they're really going to be able to do for the person's body. Person's soul is a different thing. But as far as caring for the person's body, there's not much you're going to be able to do once we have stimas hagolel, once the pile is on top of the grave, that's it. So that's probably the easiest way to understand the p'tur at this point. That we want the person to focus on the mace, A, to make sure the mace is taken care of, and B, I would add, so that there aren't guilt feelings afterwards, that I could have done more to get my relative buried in the proper way at this time. That's Aninus. And anyone who's been through Aninus, it's downright bizarre. It's a downright bizarre feeling that people have. At the time of burial, there's a tremendous change. And we go from a state where the person has no halachot to a time where a person has a tremendous number of halachot. It's very interesting. It's not simply that once the grave is covered, suddenly, yechayev again. You say Kriya Shema. According to some opinions, put on tefillin. And you don't do that on the first day. But some say you should still put on tefillin on the first day, maybe without a bracha. You rush to do a couple of mitzvos. It's not a couple of mitzvos that carry you once you leave the gravesite. It's an intense amount of halacha. Why are we hit with such an intense amount of halacha during Shiva? The answer, I think, is simple. If you want to know how much guidance Chazal thought we needed during an emotionally difficult time, if you want to know how hard Chazal felt it was to feel the right feelings and think the right things, look at the amount of halacha that's associated with a particular time. There's a direct correlation with how much halachic involvement and how much we want you to feel in a completely different realm. How do we know that it's so hard to really sense the fact that we are free today as Jews and we were taken out of Egypt several thousand years ago? How hard is it to recreate such a thing? Obviously very hard. Because why do we drive ourselves so crazy during Pesach? Why is Pesach so complex? Why has the Seder over time become so misudar, so organized? Because the more difficult something is to experience were we to try it ourselves, the more halacha comes in and says, we're going to guide you at this point. Now, I don't mean to compare, especially at the men's session, the week of Pesach and the week of Shiva. The men's, when I give this later at Midrashet Yom Rishon, I think I could probably get a more receptive audience to that concept. But the reality is, that if we look at the intensity of the halakha, you can see how halakha is trying to work us through something very difficult. If it was so easy to come out of Shiva, if it was so easy to properly deal with a loss in a way that's halakha, a way that's theologically healthy and psychologically healthy, if it was so easy, there wouldn't be so much halakha. So what happens is that a person is thrust during the week of Shiva into intense halakha. For the first 3 days, the focus is to be completely on the mace. The person is not allowed. That's why the restrictions are so tough in terms of leaving the home. Gimel yamin lebechi. Spend 3 days just focusing on the loss, period. And it's only then that a person begins to come out of that state. During the latter part of Shiva, we generally see a tremendous amount of healing that goes on in the mourner. It is a tremendous experience. Of course, everyone's experience is different. It depends on, more than anything, a person's own psychological makeup and the relationship they had with the deceased. But the latter part of Shiva is usually a time of tremendous healing. People at the end of Shiva usually report how successful, how meaningful, how incredible these halachos are in terms of their ability to heal over the course of that week. You know what I find as a rabbi? I find that when I get someone up from Shiva, they feel like they've been sitting Shiva for a month. A month. And how helpful that is. The intense experience of Shiva distances a person from the loss and allows a person to help in terms of their grieving. So much goes on during that week. And again, every experience is different. But so much goes on that week. When they get up at the end of that week, they feel as if the death was not 7 days ago, as if it was a month ago, as if it was 2 months ago, and how helpful that feeling can be. One of the other amazing things about the halakha as we move the person, and I especially feel this at the time of Shiva, one of the most amazing aspects of the Shiva is also this moving from period to period to period, is that it also gives the person the right, the license to get up. One of the most brilliant parts of the Shiva process, of the process of going from 3 days to 4 days to Shloshim to Yud Beis Chodesh, is that Halacha says, you may not be ready for this. I always tell this to people when I get them up from Shiva. I said, there is no magic spell that's been cast upon you this morning. If I get you up at 8 o'clock in the morning, you're not supposed to feel different at 8:30 just because you left the house for a second. It's just not going to happen. But what our tradition gives us is guidelines that allow us to safely move from point A to point B to point C. If we didn't have Shiva, Shloshim, Yud Beis Chodesh, when would be the right time to go back to work? It would be very difficult to make that call. Very difficult. The tradition gives us a way of saying, okay, now it's time to move to the next thing. Why is there a custom to get people up from Shiva? This idea of walking around the block is a boba maisa. People feel that it's more important, they can't get up. If the rabbi has another emergency that morning, they sit Shiva all day because nobody got them up. There's no halacha of you have to be gotten up. There's certainly no halacha of walking around the block. Even if you want to walk, so you can walk and come back. You have to walk around the block. In Holliswood, we have really long winding blocks. It can drive you crazy. It could take you, you know, you could be done with Shloshim by the time you get around the block. So we go around the circular driveway. We try to make something like that. What does it mean to the family? What it means to the family is when the rabbi shows up, it means that the halacha says enough. You don't have to feel guilty about getting up now. Now is the time to get up. Does that mean you're cured? Does that mean you're fully psychologically healthy and all this and that? No. But that means that the halacha says, now it's time to begin to move to the next stage. What is that next stage? What is shloshim? So shloshim is a very interesting concept. What happens during shloshim is that we take our avelos on the road. That's really what we do. If you think of the different pieces of the halachos of shloshim, the fact that we don't shave, the fact that we don't take a haircut, the fact that we don't bathe in a regular fashion, the fact that we don't wash our clothes in a regular fashion, means that the mourner goes out and he or she looks and feels shvach. That's exactly what the goal, I believe, of shloshim is. You're no longer in the home. You're not sitting in the avelos all the time. You're not focused completely on the avelos. But you're also not ready to leave it behind. So what do? We say, fine. Don't shake your avelos. Take it with you out of the house. And that's really what happens during shloshim. Everybody knows you're in shloshim. You don't look right. You don't feel right. But you begin to leave the home. And it's a very powerful time somewhere between being so involved in the mourning that you can't leave your house. What does the house represent when it comes to Shiva? The house is the mourning. The house is where the candle is. The house is where the pictures today are, the person are. The house represents the intense attachment with the death. And during shloshim, you begin to come out of that. But you're not asked to drop it and leave it behind. You're told, take it with you. Everywhere you go. And that then moves into Yud Bet Chodesh. What is Yud Bet Chodesh? First of all, it's very interesting. We're not going to really discuss it this morning. Very interesting, the whole philosophy of why Yud Bet Chodesh applies only by parents and not by other potentially more tragic losses. Certainly we can envision in our mind that the loss of some of the other relatives could be, in most cases, more tragic and more intense, and yet they don't bring. And that's a separate thing to think about. Why was Yud Bet Chodesh established only by parents? I think what's clear is that Yud Bet Chodesh is not exactly a din in mourning per se. Because even with an intense loss, God forbid, of a child, God forbid, of a wife, intense loss that kind of hits a person very close to home, the mourning kind of ends after 30 days. What continues for Yud Bet Chodesh, what does it mean? Why are you not allowed to go to a simcha? Perhaps what it's about is a sense that you can't actively remove. It's almost a chutzpah. Perhaps it's almost a lack of kibud av ve'eim, and maybe that's what this is about, to actively remove whatever's left in our hearts. That was at the end of the 30 days, so we've taken it on the road and we did our mourning, and now we're sort of ready to go back to things. What we're not supposed to do during the last 11 months is to go to put ourselves in situations where we're gonna completely bring ourselves out of that. We're going to push it away. Don't go to a concert where the music is going to take you into a different place. You're not exactly mourning, but you're also not doing things that'll accelerate the pushing of those feelings out of the heart. What I've tried to do in the first two explanations here is the two are kind of really part of the first one, to give you a sense of what the halachos are at each stage, and to give you a sense of how it helps the mourner heal. That each progressive stage of the avelos is less. Each progressive stage speaks to the psychological feelings of the mourner at the time, and allows the person to kind of make their way through the year. As the year goes on, and the death is further behind them, they're able to drop certain kinds of things as they go forward. That's the first, most basic, I think, approach to what this year is about. Rabbi Maurice Lam, who of course, as you know, has done so much work in terms of the mourning process, consolation,
So he takes this actually to a different level. And he discusses the fact that the mourner is both separated from and then reintegrated into the community over the course of the process here, over the course of the year. In other words, Rabbi Lam suggests that it's not simply that a person, that the laws of Avelos correspond with the feelings that I have inside, that as those feelings wane, I'm able to move forward, but suggests that one of the most difficult psychological pieces of mourning is not just dealing with the loss, but the loss and the state of mourning vis-a-vis my relationships with others. When someone loses a close relative, there is a feeling that no one else truly understands what I am going through. And there may have been other people in the community who suffered losses, and sometimes there's a lot of chevra. Look at the relationships that grow from men who say Kaddish together during the year. It's intense. It is an intense experience. When a person is in psychological stress, distress, trauma, there's a sense that nobody else really understands what I'm going through now. That's natural. When I run into somebody who gets it, it's an incredible feeling of relief. And that's part of what goes on with two men who are somewhat friendly and end up saying Kaddish during the year together, is the sense that this person gets where I am right now, especially if the deaths were around the same time. Look at two people who lost a parent within a couple of weeks and the relationship that they may develop over the year of saying Kaddish. Rabbi Lam explains as follows. What is another reason for the patur at the time of Aninus? What is another reason that a person is patur from mitzvos, especially from the positive mitzvos when the person dies? Because when a person dies, the relative feels completely disconnected from the community and from every other relationship that he or she has. You know, you always want to know, a good friend loses a parent. Should I go over? Should I go to their home now? And there's this tug, and sometimes you go, and you're not sure what you're doing there, and you try to help. It's a very strange feeling. People generally want to be somewhat alone after they had a loss, because they naturally feel very, very disconnected, and they feel that that makes sense that they should be disconnected. There is a feeling of tremendous separation and isolation at the time of the death. And that is to some extent reflected in the p'tur from mitzvos. Mitzvos are the things that connect us to our community, to our tradition. And it reflects that feeling that I'm all alone. What happens over the course of the grieving process? So Rabbi Lam has an amazing, amazing image that he teaches his students to. He used to teach all the rabbinical students Avelos, not the halachos of Avelos, but the hashkafos of Avelos, which are just as important for the rabbi to understand. He said, did you ever notice that when we get to a funeral, when we get to a burial, we get to the Beis Olam, so everybody kind of, now this is obviously not inherent, it's just the way it works out, but it's a very powerful image on some level. Everybody parks their cars along the road, and everybody goes in sort of a mass to the gravesite. And the person, the avel, him or herself, is sort of just floating around in that group. That's how we go to the gravesite. How do we leave the gravesite? With the friends standing in a line, and the person going straight through the line. We get to the gravesite with a feeling of isolation, a feeling of confusion. And after the mace has been taken care of, after the Stimas Hagolel, we as the community say to the mourner, we are now here to provide you structure again. Here's the line. Now you come and you walk between us again. What happens over the time, over the 3 days and the 4 days and the 30 days and the year, is that the mourner is able to once again join society. Not just heal, and this of course is part of healing, but to join society. So during the aninos itself, he or she is completely disconnected from society. The reality is the person is generally home in their home and there's nobody there and they're not following the traditions and they don't come to shul. Until the mourning, they don't, until the burial, they don't accept tanchumen. I'm not really sure how the whole lineup and make the people greet everyone on the way in. That's not a real halachic idea that there should be a reception room at the funeral. That's really not proper. People are generally not ready for it. I've seen families that it was excruciatingly difficult to sit there and have to nod at everyone as they walk through. They're completely not ready for that. And the halacha says they're not supposed to be ready for that yet. What the most proper thing to do is just to walk past and just nod your head and that's it. It's not a time for consolation. You don't try to be Menachem and Avo while Meso Mutalafanov before the person's buried. At the time of the burial, once that's done, we begin to give the person structure. They walk through these straight lines, but they go home and they remain alone. It's just close friends. Their contact with civilization, this community's all the way out here. They have a little bit of contact with people the first 3 days. What happens the next 4 days? A lot of contact. But where is that contact? On their terms, in their place, in the middle of the mourning. You ever have that feeling that you have to pay a shiva call because if you don't make it during the 7 days, what are you going to say to the person afterwards? There's something, if you think about it, about the ability to meet someone at their own shiva home first that is unbelievably healthy in terms of the reestablishing of relationships. The person begins to reintegrate them into society in their mourning. They don't give anything up. They're sitting on their chair in their home with the candle, with the pictures, with everything. At the end of the 7 days, they kind of go halfway. And here's where that taking it with you is so effective. We tell the person, okay, now it's time to begin to reintegrate into society. But you're going to take the mourning with you. We're not going to ask you to leave it behind. You're going to feel very funny if you do that. Take it with you. At the end of the 30 days, they rejoin society, but not completely, because they're not expected to be where everybody is when everyone else is celebrating. They're expected to rejoin society, to be part of the community again, but not expected to be part of the community when the community is celebrating a wedding. And then at the end of the year, that process is complete. The person has been taken from the complete isolation of aninos, from the moment of death, through the process to slowly reintegrate them into society, and how incredibly effective it is. So the first thing we looked at was, after we got through the halachot themselves, how the stages of mourning are weaning the person away from the death, helping them to recover from the death. The second approach we're looking at, how it helps them to reintegrate into society. Number three. Why is it, approach number three, that the mourning is so intense at first and becomes weaker as the year goes on? The altar of Kelm has a very interesting approach in several places where he discusses the need to mourn with, listen to what I'm saying, with the soul of the person. Not just for the soul of the person, but with the soul of the person. One of the great theological questions about mourning is, why are we mourning? What are we mourning for? The person's in a better place. They're receiving the reward for all the great things that they did. They're having the time of their life. Or that. What am I sitting here and crying for? It almost looks like I'm a kofer. I'm an apikairis. I don't believe there's a world to come, so that's why I'm so upset. What am I so upset for? The person didn't die. The person went to a better place. So it's generally understood that I'm not mourning for them. I'm mourning for me. It's very sad for me. I'm very sad. I'm not going to have the person anymore. I'm not sad for them. But in the Svarim, they write that there is an aspect of mourning for the person, because after death, the person goes through a very, very difficult time before they're settled in the Olam HaEmes. The Svarim write that after we die, we are judged. And that the judgments are harshest at the beginning and simpler and easier as time goes on. The most difficult judgment that the soul goes through is during the first 3 days after death. During the first 3 days after death, there's an intense period where, again, different images from the Kabbalah, the soul may be even restored to the body temporarily to face punishment with the body in the kever. There's a very serious period of judgment during the 7 days. And that period of judgment extends basically for the 30 days. I don't know what it means to be judged in the next world. But one way of explaining what it means to be judged in the next world is that we will be shocked with how wrong we were. At the fires of Gehenna, Rabbi Arya Kaplan explains that the fires of Gehenna are not actual fires, but feelings of tremendous embarrassment upon being so wrong and so off. And we've all experienced that in this world. It's an absolutely terrible feeling to be devastated emotionally by a decision that we made that was wrong. Devastated. How could I? How stupid could I have been? How did I do that? It may be that when we get to the next world, all we need to be shown is the truth. That may be punishment enough. Just to be shown the truth. Just to be shown, as some have explained, a videotape of our lives. You know, I do the professional training of the rabbis here. So, as you know, it's difficult for people to listen to a rabbi for any length of time. So we really put a lot of work into training them now. So instead of just rabbis like myself doing the speech training, we brought in professional trainers from Toastmasters and things like that. The most painful moment in Smicha is when these guys have to watch themselves speak. Very painful. Because we've all heard speakers, and we were pained to hear them speak. But it's never painful when you're speaking. But even when you have to listen to yourself speak, it can be painful, right? You watch the video. I always used to hate that when I used to train in speaking. I hated watching myself on video. That's what we're going to have to do, so to speak, when we get to the next world. The shock, the embarrassment, the sense of feeling appalled at ourselves. How did I do this? Like we say before Yom Kippur, we say in the Tefillah Zaka, right? Eich ne'esesa ha-toeva hazos. Eich ne'esesa ha-toeva hazos. How did I do this? There's an intense, intense feeling that compromises, that makes up a certain amount of the judgment that a person goes through after their soul leaves their body. One thing is for sure, we believe that we're conscious after we die. We know who we were, and we know what we did. If we're not, we can't really be judged. If I won't know who I am after I die, then why do I care so much about what's going to happen then? If you look at the source sheet, you see on the first page, Betach shoma mimeni yedidi et asher shamati b'shem ha'admor ha'saba mikelem.
Mikelem. The altar of Kelem.
Hu amar, listen to this, ki inyan ha'avelus, hu rak lihiyot nosei ba'ol im ha'niftar.
Wow.
He asks, how could it be that we mourn for someone? It's apikorsus. Why don't we say the person's in a better place, we believe in Olam Haba, and therefore we should be happy when the person dies? The answer is the person's not so happy when they die. And the inyan of avelus, he says, is to be nosei ba'ol im chavero. We've heard of that phrase with the living. It's striking to see it with regard to the dead. That the idea of mourning at the beginning, the reason for the intense mourning is we're with this person that we loved so much. We know they're going through such a difficult time. We're not sitting shiva for them, so to speak, he says. We're simply refusing to have any joy when they are in such a difficult situation. He says, and look at the second paragraph from the bottom. Im ha'ma'ora rachmano litzlan bekrovim, asher b'teva hu margish b'tzaram af b'chayehem, kol shekein b'misosam. If these are people we were close with, and we feel their pain when they're suffering in life, of course we should feel their pain when they're suffering in death. To sit shiva is the ultimate act of belief, because we believe that not only is there a world to come, but there's judgment that precedes the world to come. How long does that judgment continue? What's the longest a person can stay in Gehenna before any normal person will be able to get to Olam Haba? 12 months. How long is the longest that we mourn? For 12 months. We are joining the person that we loved. He says it's a lesson in Musar. That just as we care for people and we can't forget about their plight when they're living, we can't forget about their plight when they're dead. There's a piece which I was afraid to put in your source packet from the Or Yechezkel, from Rav Yechezkel Abramsky. And he writes of a fellow who passed away in the community, and how the person came to him in a dream on the night of the Shloshim. And he says, the only thing he asked of me was, Lihiyot nosei ba'ol imo. I didn't put this in the packets. Too weird. But the concept is certainly one that we believe in. That when a person is in the next world, what they want from us is to be with them. To carry the burden with them, to mourn with them. And by the way, it's not only to mourn with them, it's to constantly think of how we can help them. We believe that the soul, the majority opinion is that the soul of the person can be helped by what we do here. The Ma'avar Yabok, a classic sefer of Avelus and of life after death, the Ma'avar Yabok says that we should be intensely involved with mitzvot in their memory at the beginning. During the first year, and actually during the Shloshim, and actually during the Shiva. It's not necessarily correct the way we usually do the Limud Mishnayos, which generally starts after the Shiva is finished. During Shiva, everybody's confused. And the Avelim themselves are usher for them to learn Torah. So generally, let's face it, when we all learn for a Shloshim, right? And it's a very nice thing today, so much more. I never saw this 15, 20 years ago. Now, when somebody passes away, they learn Mishnayos for the Shloshim. It's very beautiful. When do most people learn the Mishnayos? The day before the Shloshim, right? They always ask me, should we do it for the Shloshim or do it for the yard sites? I said, anyway, they're going to do it in one day. So, you could do it for the Shloshim or the yard sites. It's human nature. That's not when they need it! That's not when they need it. They don't need it a day before the Shloshim's over. If you sign up to learn from Mishnayos, start learning during the Shiva. That's what the Svarim say. That's when they need it the most. That's when they're going through the most intense judgment. And the Ma'avar Yabok says we should be marbid with Tehillim and Mishnayos and things like that during the Shloshim and especially during the Shiva. And the obligation of the Avelim is not to learn during the Shiva because they can't, but to get the Siyah Mishnayos going during the Shiva itself. That's when they need it. There's a discussion looking forward to the year about whether a person should say Yizkor during the first year. The different minhagim as to whether you say Yizkor when you're in Avelis. One Svara says that you'll be so sad that it'll ruin your Yontif. During the first year, you really feel intense. You're certainly going to cry during Yizkor. And you shouldn't do that to your Yontif. And the Gesher Achayim, who takes more of a Kabbalistic approach, says, wait a minute. During the first year is when they really need the Yizkor. After the first year, they don't need it nearly as much. They're going from sitting up in the mezzanine, now you're going to get them into the box seats. But during the first year, they're going through the punishments of Gehenna. So the Gesher Chaim says, that's what you have to say. And again, there are different opinions, and they all have a basis. But a more Kabbalistic approach says that we have to be no se ba'ol im chavero. Fascinating concept. That the reason why the mourning is most intense at the beginning and then it moves forward is so that we can go through this experience with the mace. Let me finally take this one step forward. And this last piece is sort of a bridge between this third section and the fourth. I think that one of the keys to understanding the laws of mourning is to understand this crazy period of aninus. What happens during aninus? There's a patur in mitzvahs. Why is a person patur from mitzvahs during aninus? So we said it's so they have the ability to take care of the person. We said because they feel very isolated. But I'll add another reason why you're patur from mitzvahs in aninus. When a person dies, what do we say about them? We don't say they died, they passed away, they went to the Olam HaEmes. What do we say? They were nifter. Do you ever wonder how strange that is to say someone was nifter? What does nifter mean? They're pater. Pater from what? Pater from mitzvahs. That's true. But not terribly relevant to my mind. There's a lot of things they're not going to do now. Why do we say that someone was nifter when they died? Because from a hashkafic perspective, the main difference is now that they can't do mitzvos. The most salient feature of death is now that they can't do mitzvos. That shocks the way we look at the world. We think we're in the world to live. We're in the world to do mitzvos. When a person passes away, we say, yes, they're not here, they can't give you a hug, they can't eat breakfast, they can't eat lunch, but most of all, they can't do mitzvos. Why are you putter for mitzvos during aninus? On top of the other reasons I would suggest, to be no se ba'olim chaveiro. If you feel disoriented when you can't do mitzvos, and you put something into your mouth and you can't say a bracha, and it pains you because you're saying, I wish I could say a bracha, imagine what the person feels like. That's being no se ba'olim chaveiro. And with that, I'll enter the fourth and final explanation of what the stages of Avelis are about. If you look at the last page, the Gesher Achayim goes through where the soul is at each stage of the Avelis. The Gesher Achayim points out, based primarily on the Zohar and Vayakel, that just as a person down here goes through stages, the soul also goes through stages. The soul is at first terribly confused and terribly worried until the burial. Where is the soul for the first 3 days? The Kabbalah tells us the soul is hovering over its own body, completely immersed in the fact that it's dead and hoping it will go back in, as strange as that sounds. On the third day, the body starts to rot. And the soul gives up. But for the first 3 days, the soul stays hovering over the body, wondering if it can go back in. It's completely, completely immersed in the mourning for itself. From day 4 until day 7, it goes back and forth. It goes from the grave, wouldn't you, to the Shiva home. He kind of wishes it could be at the Shiva home with the family in the beginning. But in the beginning, it's so intensely interested in getting back into its own body that it stays there, separated. And during the first, from day 4 to 7, it begins to travel from the place of the kever to the place where the Shiva is being sat, to be and to see what their family is doing. Wouldn't you want to do that? During the next 30 days, according to the Kabbalah, the soul divides itself. On the one hand, checking out things down here, but also beginning to check out where things are up there. You know what part of Gehenim is? Part of Gehenim is having the most wonderful spiritual blessing, the most wonderful spiritual reward waiting for us up there, and still wishing we could have a stake down here. There's a process we go through where we're willing to say, wow, that's what I really want. And to get ourselves out of the mindset that this is what we really want. The 30 days is described in the Kabbalah as the time where the soul begins to venture out, begins to check out its new home. Then from day 30 until the end of the year, the soul is basically rooted already where it's going to be. It's already basically in the world to come. But it still has an eye down here. And following that, it's really only on the Yahrzeit that we believe that the soul really makes a connection again with this world. Let me suggest the following and then we'll end. I know we're late. What the laws of Avelis, I believe, allow is for the soul and the person to go through the same process over the course of a year. And to reintegrate themselves, as Rabbi Lamb said, into their new communities. The community of the living and the community of the dead. At the moment of Aninos, the two people are as close as they could possibly be. They're joined. They're separated from everyone else. They're confused. They're together. The only person you're with at the time of Aninos is the deceased. And you're so with them that you share a patur in mitzvos. You're exactly in the same place. And if you think about it, at each stage, the soul and the person begin to integrate or reintegrate themselves into their new home. For 3 days, being so focused on just the fact that there was a death. For the first 7 days, to begin to move away from that, to begin to focus to the Shiva home. What happens during the Shloshim? The soul begins to check out the next world. But it always has an eye of what's going down here. And the person begins to check out their old relationships and their workplace, but always with the clothes and the feeling and the not shaving that gets them the feeling that they're still in Avelos. During the Yud Bet Chodesh, they're basically back where they were. But with certain things tying them back to each other. And then how beautiful it is that every year on the Yahrzeit, the two of them leave their ordinary routines to once again bond the soul of the person and the person who's been in mourning. I think I've only tried to give you this morning a taste of the brilliance of the laws of Avelis. They're not simply a lumber of collected halachos, they're trying to produce a state. And I would argue that not only does that state have tremendous psychological benefit, but tremendous insight. Such that what we're going through down here when we mourn is exactly what the soul is going through. And as we heal and integrate into our human community, the soul is able to heal and integrate into Olam Haba. Thank you very much.